Then look at Alla Nissin for Purim. With just one little note I saw in the article today about, is it Alla Nissin or the Alla Nissin with the Vav? Okay, you'll see in the article Siddur, it actually has a Vav, but he puts it in brackets. Va'al HaNissin. He says, the Mishnah Berurah says, that's what you should think. And it fits into the context. Alright, that Me'olam Kivinu Lo, we always trust in you. Va'al HaNissin. And of course, all the modim, we thank you for everything, etc., etc., etc. Va'al HaNissin. And for the miracles, etc., which you did, etc. And then va'al kula, it's got a vav and then a vav again. So it is va'al kula. All right, so it sort of works. This whole question of the dikduk, the grammar of tefillah, is a very complicated question. My favorite example is in Aleinu, that line that's missed out, which is now being put back in. Shehei mishtachavim hevavirik. And according to the context of Aleinu, it has to be there, because it says, right? You haven't made our lot like everybody, right? And then it says after that, va'anachnu karim, is kind of not connected to the previous sentence, and we bow down, etc. If you say shehei mishtachavim, because they, the other lot, bow down to a god shelo yoshia, it doesn't say va'anachnu, and we karim mishtachavim, bow down to God. Right, so that makes sense if you put the sentence back in of Shehei Mishtachavim Lehev Avarim. The trouble is that it was censored about 500 years ago by the Christian censors, because they thought it was a fluke reference to Jesus. Because Elo Yoshia, they thought they were referring to Yeshu. Right, so that was their take on the whole thing. Even though the pasuk actually comes from Yeshaya, which is way before Jesus was born. Right, but they kind of misinterpreted all these things. We spoke about it once. The censors were a very significant part of Jewish writings. Rabbi Steinsaltz has made a big effort to put back all of the censored Gemaras to what they were. If you take the Sanhedrin Gemara and open that to page 43b, you will find that there is a whole chunk there about the history of the Jesus period, which is missing from the Gemara. In fact, in that one up there, they put it in at the back of the Gemara. They actually said, look at the back of the Gemara, and they bring the whole story. The Gemara's take on the whole thing. According to the Gemara, there was only five disciples. It kind of spoils the whole scene of the Last Supper. Instead of having 12, there were only five. Matthew, and it goes through all the names. That's kind of interesting. And again, the censor was sensitive to the whole thing, that they just, anything to do with Christianity, they cut it out. And I don't know if I mentioned to you, I was once in the library in the equivalent of YU in London. It's called Jews College. Awful name. The college had manuscripts. And what was so interesting, that one of the manuscripts was censored, and the ink was fading of the black ink which went over the words. The black ink which went over the words was fading. So you could actually see what was under, what had been censored. Kind of interesting, right? They used ink which over hundreds of years was actually fading. And there's an academic scholar from Israel, from Bar Ilan, who was doing work on this manuscript, and he pulled me over and he said, have a look at this. And it was fascinating. You could see underneath what exactly the words that had been blotted out by the censor. And there's a lot of stuff to say. We're talking about the grammar of tefillah, whether it's a vav here or not. Mashiv aruch amarid ha goshen, right? Now that's the other famous one. And Rav Soloveitcher's got a whole explanation of geshen, which is very nice. But at the end of the day, it's the end of a phrase, and I'm still convinced it has to be goshen, right? Because if it was geshen, then it would be umachal kerchain. It's like we're saying here, the al hanisim. It would be a continuation. Well, again, goshen is the end of a phrase. Because it changes to a comment when it's like an etnachta, right? It's the kun of etnachta at the end of a pasuk. And then, if it's the end of a phrase, then you go like an end of a sentence. Then the next sentence, machal kechaim, is a new sentence. But if it's geshen, then that would be a continuation of the phrase, and therefore probably you would have to say umachal kechaim. Right? I tried that one on Asaf Bednar. She didn't go for it because he's into the Soloveitcher stuff. Yeah, and. Yeah, they put in the newer Siddurim, they put Geshem and Goshem, Yeshomrim and whatever you want to say. And it kind of gets a bit silly, the whole thing. The Tikkun Meir Siddur, which we all grew up with, the illegible Siddur that was published in the Hebrew Publishing Company.
I grew up with Birnbaum.
Oh, you grew up with the Birnbaum, you see. I come from England. We grew up with the Tikkun Meir, which was published in America. The Birnbaum was from England. Yeah. The Birnbaum is a good Siddur. It's a good Siddur. That was definitely Murid HaGoshen. There's no discussion about that. But there are these little quirks in davening which are really strange. Bits that are added, bits that are censored, bits that are put in. There's a whole sort of world to say. In this context, Va'al Hanisin to me makes more sense. It's put in brackets here. You know, it depends on your nusach, what you say. As always, the art score is very non-committal. So he'll leave it, put it in brackets, and it's up to you whether you say it. Like Shehei Mishtachar didn't have a rick, he's also kept it in parentheses. So you want to say it, say. You don't want to say it, don't say it. Does it fit into the niggun of a lane?
He wants to appeal to all markets.
He's really hedging his bet. Yeah, and it sells. But the Rinat Yisrael Siddur, the Israeli Siddur, Shehei Mishtachar is there without brackets, because that's part of a lane. It was the original nusach of a lane. And if you say a lane, it goes back to... originally, the original format goes back to Yeshua ben Nun, right? So that's really as old as that. Although that pasuk is found in Sefer Yeshayahu. So the question is, who introduced it after? It's obviously introduced at a later date, because the tefillah itself goes back to Yeshua ben Nun. So if you've got a pasuk from Yeshayahu, historically somebody would have had to put it in there. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm not really into the whole history of this, but this is all very academic. If you look at the page that I've given you, what we're going to do is we're going to look a bit at Alanisim of the Alanisim of Bimei Mordechai Ve'Esther. Right? The first question really is that just look at the page 114, and Purim gets a very bad deal. All right, Alanisim of Hanukkah. Look at this chunky paragraph that you have over here, meaty paragraph. I'm trying to sort of give the metaphor. It's a solid steak, right? What do you get over here for Purim? You get kind of, you know, you get the dessert. You get the a little slither at the end. This is like the little piece. So why so much less for Purim than you have Hanukkah? He actually brings this in the notes over here in the Siddur, but I've got it on the page in front of you. This is from a Sefer Avodah Shebaleh, which we've quoted a number of times. And he just says, number one, section A, Hodor harbe yosek tzara b'yumei matisyo. In other words, Alanisim for Hanukkah for Purim is much. Hanukkah. Hanukkah. The Alanisim for Hanukkah is much longer than the one for Purim. Or put it the other way around, the one for Purim is much shorter. Ki Haman haya rosha begolui, because Haman was an open rosha, right? Everybody knew he was evil. Velo tzarich laharich, and you don't have to dwell on that. Kind of obvious. It's taken for granted, right? Aval hayivanim adarav, with the Greeks, it was the other way around. Maybe they wanted to, as it were, you know, do some sort of make nice to Klal Yisrael, right? Because Greek culture was the flavor of the month in those days. Uritzonam, and their desire, Raksha Klal Yisrael Yenu Mitarbutam, that the Jewish people should have benefit from their culture. So therefore, this is Rav Hirsch. And Rav Hirsch basically says that therefore the Purim, Alanisim, is much shorter because everything was on the table. You knew that Haman wanted to kill you, and you knew that God saved you, so you don't have to embellish the whole thing. You don't have to say that Zaydim Yad Sadiqim, or whatever, it's the whole thing. It's a main Biyad Taharim, Shom Biyad Sadiqim. We don't have to go through all of that. Because there, the battle at Hanukkah was much more subtle. Right? And therefore, the Yeshua was also a much more subtle salvation. When it comes to Purim, direct. Right? I mean, that's sort of Hirsch. He brings us over here in the notes. In the English notes as well.
So if you look at the language in the Vatican thing, it's very, very, very long.
Right. What none of these authors do, exactly, who actually wrote, is clearly two different people writing this. One could assume just by the terse language of Purim as opposed to the flowery language of Hanukkah, which nobody goes into in terms of the authorship of who wrote these paragraphs. All right, was it Anshei Knesset HaGedolah? The answer is no, because they were much before these events. All right, the tefillah is generally attributed to the men of the Great Assembly. They are the beginning of the Second Temple period. Well, you can certainly say maybe the Al-Nisim for Purim was written at that time, because it's before that.
You cut out from Vasa Barachamecha to Vahachar Cain, you have the same length for Hanukkah, and you'll say the same thing.
Right.
Without all that flowery
without
stuff.
Without the flowery stuff. So where did all that come from?
Well, even maybe, Vasa Barachamecha on Purim is only six words.
Rabim. Whereas what does it say on Hanukkah? It's a whole introduction here. So clearly, clearly what's happening with the Hanukkah tefillah is there's much more arikos, it's not much longer for the purposes of embellishing the miracle, because of the attack was much more subtle.
Seems like the style of the writer, you know, alluded to different people.
And the style is different.
Poetic,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, archy kind of a writer.
Yeah, whereas Purim, it's straight to the point. All right? They wanted to kill us. We won, and we eat. That's basically what happened. Okay, we eat. That's the conclusion. That's what happens in Purim. Well, actually, we drink more than we eat, but depending on your take on that particular halacha, so-called mitzvah.
It's so cool.
Very, very complicated. We had wonderful arrangement in Gator. Always remember, Matisyahu Salam was now the mashgiach in Lakewood. You could get drunk just by walking in the house. You didn't have to drink anything because the atmosphere was thick with liquor. It was the most amazing experience. And you walked in there and you came out, your head was spinning. The Rosh Yeshiva, the next Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Gurvich, lived a block away. And he had a massive kumkum, like a kettle, Shabbos kettle, full of black coffee. And as soon as you got here, you got handed a mug of black coffee just to calm you down from the experience of coming from the previous rabbi. It was really quite well done. You know, you came from one to the other. From the sublime to the ridiculous. It was a really great experience. I'm sure they still have people like that there today, but it's really funny. Unforgettable. I'm sure if you want to go to Lakewood, you'll see Rav Salomon probably has the same thing. You can smell his house from half a mile away. Pretty amazing. The next item I just want to deal with is Shlalom Lavoz, just very quickly. One of the comments of the Al-Nisim. We're going to deal with different parts of the Al-Nisim, but let's just see what Shalom Lavoz was all about. If you look at the wording, just before we do the paragraph, Shalom Lavoz over here is, one second, where are we? Let's just read the Purim one. B'nei Mordechai v'Esther b'shushan Avira, right? K'sh'omad aleh Muhammad Arashah, Haman Stadah, b'kesh la'hashmid la'arog la'abe, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate, right? Which is obviously the language of the Megillah, right? There's Kol Yehudim. All the Yehudim, on one day, all the people, man, woman, and children, and he wanted to take their spoil. All right, and where does that come from?
Permission.
That's and have permission for that. Now the question is, what really is the Shlalom Lavoz adding to the whole story, to the whole description over here? Once the people were dead, then the spoil would be taken automatically. It's kind of a strange thing to mention. All right, the main gezeira was to kill them. To mention the spoiling of the property is something which may have taken place, but doesn't really add
but
anymore.
But actually, in the Megillah, in Perek Chet, it says both in Shushan and in the rest that they didn't touch anything.
They didn't touch anything.
They took nothing.
Now, of course, that but Haman clearly saw this as a way of encouraging people to go ahead and do what they had to do. It's kind of interesting. We were talking about this in school today. What did Haman, you know, if you were the ultimate anti-Semite and you want to get the annihilation of the Jews, what do you write or how do you encourage people to do this? It's
but
not such an easy
have.
Thing to do. The Nazis were brilliant at it, but it took them 6 years of propaganda day and night before you convinced the whole of Germany and eventually the whole occupied world that they could do this, right? And Poland, you didn't have to work very hard. Because the Polish had this in their blood from birth anyway. Right? That's why you had Auschwitz in Poland. Sorry?
The Ukrainians
they all had this in their system. But for the Germans, the so-called culture Germans, to be convinced about this, it took propaganda day and night for 6 years. All right? And the speed of the Purim story is quite amazing in terms of how quickly the message got across that, you know, we've got an opportunity to kill the Jews. It's very strange. And what he wants to point out here, Shlalom Avos was part of it. If you offer people a monetary incentive, they'll do anything. All right, that's the suggestion. It's kind of interesting. Okay, there was also, you know, so you got the benefit of getting rid of the Jewish people, and not only that, you had the benefit of their spoil. And of course, in Poland today, it's still a big issue. There was a woman, it must have been well, it's a bit longer than that now, it must be about 4 or 5 years ago, whose property was taken over by the Poles and eventually by the Germans, on which one of the camps of Auschwitz was built. And this is a Jewish woman who wanted to get her compensation. And people told her, she lives in Israel, and people said, don't go back, they won't listen to you, nothing. She said, Dafka, I want to do it because I want them to know that this camp was built on Jewish property. And I want them at least to recognize it. And she actually went back. And there's a whole documentary about how she negotiated with the Polish authorities, but she got nothing from them. They didn't want to know. But as they were concerned, that was all part of war, all right? And they didn't want to know. But there are people going back to Poland still who are claiming, after 50 or 60 years, you know, this is my house. And the Poles, particularly the first couple of years after the war, were so sensitive about it that there was even pogroms about it. They're in Kielce in 1946, they killed 46 Jews because of this. Because they thought the Jews were coming back to take their property. After the war, they killed 46 Jews one night, and that kind of...
Listen to Yaffa Eliyahu's story about when her family went back, and they killed them.
And they killed them. It was just terrible, terrible rishis. So Shlomo Ravos fits into that theme. And I'll just run through this very quickly. He says like this. This is again, in paragraph A, but it's the third section. Shlomo Ravos, Im Hayo, it's got a 2 next to it. In other words, as far as the dead people are concerned, what difference does it make whether you took the spoil or not? They're dead. Basically, the whole point was that the people should not be lazy. Omar b'shem ha-melech, so he said in the name of the king, she'yesh l'olam l'voz esahorugim v'lo yukarugim malchus shemon l'melech. And of course, what happens is that if they're killed by the order of the king, the money normally goes to the king. So the people will say, why should I bother to go and kill the Jews? The king's going to get all the money anyway, right? It's the property of the crown. So the answer is that Haman made a deal, seemingly, that the people would keep the spoil. That's kind of an interesting fact. And you know, when you look through the Megillah, next week, we'll look out for that point. He says it's chapter 3. He says here 3:13. So we'll have to have a look at the Megillah and see what the Megillah actually says about that. Because that's kind of an interesting point, which I've never thought about. All right, how do you get the people to go and kill the Jews? You've got to give them a monetary incentive. Okay, this is the world, sort of the real world, unfortunately, the way it is. And he explains, ki bezeh chalash yomar giborani. Even the weak one will say, I'm strong. Al chemdat ha-shalal, because of the desire for the spoil, la rogel abed, and then he'll go and kill and destroy. Ulezarzeh. And to speed it up, as it were, to encourage them, Omar laro gushlolam lovos, right? And he says, you'll kill them and you'll get the spoil. Acha hiskiru herig ve'ibut, kotum ve'godam. This is after he mentions that you're going to kill man, woman, and child. Lo mar, to say, shalo yehi shlolam lovos, rak acha sheyargu kulam. In other words, it's only going to be after you kill them all, then you'll get the spoil. That's the deal. Baal yidnu leiv lishlol shalal, and they're rogin rishonov yichyu anosorim. That will stop the people taking off the spoil after killing a few and running off, right? O yivrechu l'malit nashal, they'll run away to save themselves. The Alshe. It's very interesting. So the deal was, kill them all and then you can divide up the spoil afterwards. Which is kind of an added sort of item in the Megillah, which, again, you know, when you read it next week, it might be just something to look out for. There's one other item which, again, I'm not going to talk about this evening, but it will be something that is worth pointing out to you, is the reference to Esther in the Megillah. It's not on the page here. Esther is sometimes referred to as Esther without the title Hamalka, and sometimes she's referred to as Esther Hamalka. And it's very significant because the changeover is around Perek Hay, when she all of a sudden becomes Esther Hamalka.
When she acts like a queen,
and
when she goes and she stands up,
and the whole vort of that deal, and it's a very big deal in the whole Megillah, is that until she recognizes Esther Malka by Achashverosh, she's very happy, because he doesn't want another Vashti. He doesn't want none, because remember Vashti was the Yichus, she was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, so marrying Vashti was marrying that was the ticket to power. Right now Vashti's gone. The last thing he needs is another queen to come along and tell him what to do. So he's looking for somebody as anonymous and as non-queen person as possible. That's Esther. Until, of course, you find out who's Esther descended from. Shaul HaMelech. She's in the family of the king of Israel, right? So that's when Esther becomes Esther HaMalka. It's very interesting. there's a whole interplay, and you look at the Megillah, look for that, those places where all of a sudden, instead of just being plain old Esther, plain young Esther, whatever she was, she becomes Esther HaMalka, the queen. And that is a very big turning point in the whole story. Because Achashverosh realizes that she's the queen, and he still accepts it. Right? Initially, he wasn't going to do it, and then he changes his mind. I'm pointing that out because there are themes over here which we're going to be seeing, which you can look at. You know, it's always nice to have something to think about when you're hearing the Megillah for the 105th time, you know, maybe something new, something different, some focus which I haven't seen before. So that's one that is really interesting, and there's a whole shiur on that which maybe one day we'll get a chance to say over. Look at B, because this again is interesting. Back to the Nusach of Al HaNisim, and comparing it to from Chanukah to Purim, or Purim to Chanukah. In Purim it just says at the beginning, Kisha Omad Aleihem. He got up against them. Look at Chanukah, where it says, Kisha Omda Malchus Yoman Harashah Al Amcha Yisrael. They got up against your people Israel. So why in the Purim version of events, it's only Aleihem, against them, kind of condensed version. And in the Chanukah version, it says Amcha Yisrael. It spells out who the them really is. All right. In other words, in Chanukah, it could have saved you three words. It said, "Kesha Amad Yovan Malchus Yovan Harosha Aleihem," like it doesn't prove. Why does it say in Chanukah Al Amcha Yisrael, stressing the concept of Yisrael, whereas in Purim Aleihem, it doesn't go into detail. So have a look at this. This is interesting. There's two reasons. Section B, and this is the Shiras Dovid, which is again another contemporary, lives in Cleveland, Rabbi Goldberg. Lo ne'amar kan al Amcha Yisrael kamo she'omrim b'Chanukah. We don't say Amcha Yisrael as we do with Chanukah. Ela aleihem, right? And he's going to give two reasons. Yesh levai b'zal p'imasha kosov agrot. The Esther. Now, if you've never looked at the Vilna Gaon's commentary on Esther, you have to look at it. It's just phenomenal. The nuances and the diyuk. I mean, the Gro very, very rarely allows himself to be such a pashtan. And in the Megillas Esther, he explains pshat all the time, with such twists and turns. It's a fabulous thing. That's a study unto itself, which is worth doing once. But he says like this on that particular point. Shahaman rotza lahastes agazerim ayehudim. Right, again, I'm thinking of the Germans. Haman wanted to hide the decree. All right, again, like the Germans, what did they say to the Jews? You're going to be relocated. Right, and people fell for it almost to the point of no return. They didn't realize what they say. They didn't know what was going on until they were in the gas chamber. It's unbelievable. And there's precedent for this. It says that Haman wanted to hide the gazerim. Mea Yehudim, what he was doing to the Jews, hide it from the Jews, Kadesh lo yishtad lo etzel asroot, so they shouldn't make any efforts with the powers to be to get out of the situation, all right? Or whatever it is, you know, they should go quickly and silently. There should not be any hassle against killing the Jews. This is a theme which we've seen. We saw this in the Holocaust, and it comes from Homer. Olechein, and therefore, b'patshegen aktav, when he sends out the letter, Lo hiski hashmadat ha-yudim. It doesn't mention the destruction of the Jews. Rak sheyiyu atidim liyom hazeh. It just says, be ready for this day. Right? It doesn't really say what be ready for what. Alright? Ayem ha-sheh kosa b'zeh shiros dovid. And he explains that. Olechei ne'emar rak aleihem. In Purim it's only aleihem, because it was hidden. It wasn't an announcement that the Jews are going to die initially. It was just that there's going to be a gezerah aleihem, whoever they are going to be. Kind of a more anonymous sort of thing. Shelo hiskir b'pumbi, didn't mention openly Shabar neged Yisro. He's coming against the Jews. Ela hisstir masa. What did Haman do? He just kept it all under wraps. Aval etzil yovan, when it came to the Greeks, and maybe you can say the Greeks are more honest. Shabo bereish galay, they came with a revealed head, an open mind, an open head as it were, not open mind, open head. In other words, with seeing clearly. Lilochem im Am Yisrael ne'amal Amcha Yisrael. That's why it says Amcha Yisrael, because they came and they said they were clearly attacking the religion of Israel, and there was no discussion and no hiding it from the Jews. The Greeks were more honest and they were more direct in their attack. When it came to Haman, he tried to cover up, and that again is a classic ploy of the anti-Semite, covering up the intention. You see this, I was just again talking about this today. If you go onto the web, how many web pages there are which are anti-Semitic. There are thousands. I wouldn't exaggerate, but there are literally thousands.
white supremacists and
Ku
Klux Klan.
Really,
they've reprinted Henry Ford's disgusting book that he wrote against the Jews. He was one of the most rabid anti-Semites that ever lived, which always put me off buying the Ford car even in England. What it's like here, I don't know, and I don't want to discuss it. In England, you got around it because they were probably made whatever. They were subcontracted to another company anyway. But the concept of Henry Ford and what he stood for is really an awful person. I think Walt Disney wasn't far behind, as far as I know.
So one
is found out. Anyway, that's just putting that to one side. The whole idea that and again, all these pages are very subtle. They're all trying to cover up their agenda. But you know what the agenda is, right? The agenda is that they would basically like to see. I don't know whether they want to see the destruction of the Jewish people. Nobody says that so openly, but they clearly have issues with the Jews, you know, in terms of their public position in the country. And you know, there's no surprises with this stuff. But again, the idea of hiding it is very significant. That's why it's Aleihem. It's not Amcha Yisrael. It's Aleihem to signify Haman was hiding it from everybody. All right, the king knew about it, and that's about it at that stage. But clearly, there was going to be, you know, more to come. And look at the next possibility. This is very interesting. We always have a bit of Kabbalistic interest in what we're learning. We had this a few weeks ago. Even last week we saw something. But Ode Yeshlama, he says, another suggestion. Alpi Mashakosa B'Nefesh HaChaim. It's found in Reb Chaim Volozhin. The Nefesh HaChaim, the student of the Unagon. Shah Aleph Perik Tet Zayim, sections Perik, chapter 16. B'Shem HaZohar. Yeah, in the name of the Zohar. Sha'al Yudei Esek HaOdam. The Hegiono B'Torah HaKadosha. What happens when a person studies Torah? What do you become? Hu Masig L'Nitzotzot, or you, as it were, how do you say this? You acquire the sparks of light, all right? There's this concept, the Kabbalistic idea of spark. Okay, it's called a very electrical idea. But it's the Nitzotzot, the sparks of God. Wherever they are, this is a very beautiful idea. You go to Tzfat, they'll tell you all about the Nitzotzot. They're big into that subject. And what does that mean? Bechinat Neshama, right? This is the concept of what's inside you, the Neshama, the soul. Bo lahaskilo, which will give you the intelligence, Be'imke razin kadishin dilei, to understand the holy secrets which are in the Torah. She'az mechuna b'shem Yisrael, and then you get the title of Yisrael. If you study Torah at that level where you understand the secrets of Torah and you go into the level of that concept of understanding of neshama, of the depth of the soul, then you are called Yisrael. Ulechein etzelei yavonim. So now we understand when it comes to the Greeks, shlerotzu lahashmin et gufa. What were the Greeks attacking? They weren't attacking the bodies of the Jewish people. They were attacking the neshamas. All right. That's why it says alamcha Yisrael. That the Greeks were attacking Israel, the neshama that studies the Torah was under attack. All right, that's an interesting suggestion. So he says that the Greeks shelo rotzu lahashmin et gufam shelam Yisrael. They weren't attacking the bodies of the Jewish people. Ela boli lachem neged chokhmat haTorah. They were attacking the wisdom of Torah. Shal yoda nikru bnei Yisrael b'shem Yisrael. That gave us the title Yisrael. And on that it says, Ne'emal Amcha Yisrael. They were attacking your people Israel. What makes your people Yisrael? Meaning the study of Torah. This is a beautiful idea. Aval b'Purim, what was Purim all about? That wasn't against Torah, that was against the Jews. She'rot Zahom and Lakas Kolam Yisrael b'Metzius the Gamre. He wants to uproot the Jews completely. In reality, Ne'emastam Omad Aleihem. It says Aleihem, doesn't have to say Amcha Yisrael. The Chalos Otam, I think you're missing the last two words there, Mimetziutam, to destroy them from existence. So it wasn't Amcha Yisrael, he wasn't attacking the Torah, he was attacking Aleihem, their physical presence. Alright, this is the theme of Purim. Purim is all about physical attack. Hanukkah was about spiritual attack. And this reflects itself in the language of Alanism, which is kind of interesting. Okay, so the Alanism is not just written stam, it's written, we've already noticed, and the one for Purim is very terse, it's very direct, it's very short, but it expresses in its own way the events from the physical perspective as opposed to Hanukkah, which is much more the spiritual perspective. Alright, so I hope that makes sense. Section C, and again we've got a few more sections, and I want to get through all of this if we can. Section C is interesting. At the end of the Al-Anisa, what does it say? Ve'ata b'rachamech harabim, and you and your great mercy, heifarta et atzato, you broke his counsel. How does he translate? Nullified his counsel. Ve'kilkalta machshavto, frustrated, spoiled, I prefer. But he says the English word, frustrated his intention. Right? You spoiled his idea. Vashevoto lo gemola barosha, and you returned his reward on his head. Alright? His design, how does he say here? And
like caused what he his planned came on him.
Came on him, right? And Vatalato Banavala Aitu, he was hanged on the tree with his sons, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But this there seems to be a, again, doubling of expression. Hey farta datsato, you broke his counsel. And you spoiled his design. What is this referring to? Right? In the end of the day, what was the plan? Kill the Jews. So what is atzato? What is machshavto? What exactly are we referring to here? Two stages of what Haman was intending to do. So again, it's a bit more of a deal. Try to understand what the process was in terms of Haman. Listen to this. And this is section C. It's very interesting. He says, Nira. It seems Hakamana Bezek Inisha Biyadam Shir David Al Esther. You've got to go back to the Megillah again. Alaposuk Vayoma HaMelech Achashverosh Mihuzeh VeEzehu. In chapter 7, Achashverosh, in a kind of wondrous expression, says, "Who is the man Asher Milu Libo Lasos Ken, who wants to do this?" You know, when Esther says, "I'm coming to tell you that there's somebody." Yeah, and of course the question is, he knows, as you say in England, jolly well who it is. How does he know? Because he's just given the permission, right, for Haman to do this. So what do you mean that Achashverosh now says, who is the one who said that he's going to kill all the Jews, when he was the one who gave permission in the first place to kill the Jews? So it's a strange question. What is Achashverosh really asking? Who is the one who wants to do this when he's talking to Esther? He knows who it is. All right? And he says, Lichor Tamu, it's very strange. So Iraq Lifnei Gimel Yomim, 3 days prior to this, Nosan Tabato Lamani already gave his ring to Haman. Lahash Minas Ayudim, right, to destroy the Jews. So now, what is the question? Umash Shaykh Lishol Mihu. Of a Malbim. This is a question obviously the Malbim raises, right? Or coins what the Malbim says. Shachashverosh Natan Reshut Rak La'abdam. What does it mean La'abdam? We always thought it meant to destroy them. He says no. Hainu La'abed Surat Ha'uma. La'abdam means to destroy the form of the people. Levatel Datam. To destroy their religion. Ulahachricham Nishmo Datot Shayeta Amim. To start observing the rules of the other nations. And that's what la'abdam actually means. Alright? La'harog or la'abed. La'abed in the sense that initially what was the permission that Achashverosh gave was la'abed. La'abed wasn't necessarily genocide. La'abed was to change them to keep the rules, the religion of the Persians, or whatever it may be. Avalo la'harogam. But not to kill them. Kind of interesting. It's a bit kiddish.
What's
again, the pasuk is chapter 2, verse 9. He says, oh no, 1 second. He says it's the Malbim. I'm parrying Bet, pasuk 10. Let's just have a look at that. Alright, you've got Megillah. Yeah, you got it there.
Yeah,
chapter 2, verse 9. See what that pasuk is. I don't think that's going to be it yet. It might actually be Gimel 3:9 as opposed to 2:9. Because 2:9 is still where Esther's being chosen. Yeah. What is pasuk 3:9? 3:9. Gimel 10. Also not. So it must be a comment of the Malbim. I'd have to look this up.
So what's the
Megillah?
The Megillah.
Well, that's the point. Initially, his suggestion is there was only La'abed. Let's just have one second. Hang on. I think he says it at the... Just so we can find this. I didn't look this up because I took this for granted. But of course, that's the lesson. You don't take these things for granted. Look at this. It is possible. 3:9. Have a look at 3:9. Imal Melech Tov Yikasev Le Abdon. Starts off with the words. It should be written Le Abdon. doesn't say yikasev la horgam.
Right.
Yikasev la abdam. So he's saying la abdam means not to kill them, just to evangelize them, basically, as you would say. All right, to use the word. So initially it was an evangelical concept. It's very interesting. All right, and that's meduyak in the person. So he says it started off like that. All right, and that was the original permission. Avalola horagam, but not the second line from the bottom there. Avalola horagam, not to kill them. V'zeu shesha'al mi huzeh. So of course now Achashverosh wants to know. I gave permission to evangelize. I didn't give permission to kill. Who was the one who gave permission to kill? All right, as if he's kind of innocent. I actually feel he probably did understand it that way, but it doesn't matter. He said, now he asked the question, me who's...
It does matter, of course it does.
But you know what I mean. Me who's Zesha, because I live in the Horgam. This is Achashverosh possibly playing the field, I'm not sure. All right, in other words, okay, we evangelized them, but did you really mean to kill them? The suggestion that what he's saying is that, no, Achashverosh understood it as an attempt to change their laws, to change their religion, but not necessarily to assimilate them. All right, and of course, what happens now is that when he hears that somebody actually made the decision to kill them, who is that guy? Right, and that is the suggestion.
I love the answer, but I have that problem.
Yeah, it is problematic.
Because I always understood it that he didn't know that Esther was Jewish.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, not really understanding. Maybe by that point he's already worked it out. We're not sure because of the of what.
I always thought he was playing.
Yeah, yeah. Mihu zevei zehu, figure the master's name. Yeah, who's that trying to do away? In other words, trying to placate her, as opposed to talking about what the real gezerah was. He's making out that the whole.
How could be the king doesn't know what?
Yeah, yeah, but certainly the diuk in the word at the beginning is interesting. Because save le abdom as opposed to le horagam, which I like that. Even though I've never really sort of dwelt on that point, but it's interesting. I don't see anything here in the whole commentary here, but I don't know. All right, something to think about. Let's just finish what he says. He says shazelo haisa kavanasa. This was not his intention. In other words, clearly the kavana, according to the way Achashverosh understood it, was not to kill them. Ubasefer tam dikra. It changes the story a bit, by the way, if you say that.
Sure does.
It really does. Yeah, changes the whole thing. Achashverosh is always this guy who comes off as a bit of an idiot, a bit of a buffoon. And he really isn't. He's a bit of a... He's actually quite a smooth operator.
No, but he's an angry drunk. That's
what he is. At the beginning.
Every time he gets drunk, he gets into big trouble because his anger takes over.
But he's a
even
very...
Even at Mishteh Yayin
Zolet. He's a smooth guy. He's not as...
He's not stupid, though.
Stupid as they make out.
He's not at all stupid.
He worked his way into power very, very... He married the right woman. And clearly he did this on purpose. And it wasn't done out
but
of...
But I really
out
don't...
Of chance.
I don't see where this interpretation plays in, considering Achashverosh, if you look at it from that point of view, was very smart.
Yeah.
Knew about, both he and Haman were well versed in Jewish history.
Yeah.
Knew about the Yirmiyahu's prediction of 70
years.
They knew
about the 70 years.
Knew
oh, yeah.
about the Nebuah, which yeah. is why he made the party in the first place. Because he figured Hashem has forgotten them.
Yeah.
That's it. They're
yeah.
lost.
But, so, but not to kill them. That wasn't his
but,
plan.
But the
Haman's plan was, but not his.
He felt at this point God has forsaken them. I can do what I want.
He can do what he wants. Yeah, but yeah. but not maybe to the extreme of genocide. That's what he wasn't planning. Achashverosh, and that's a suggestion. It's an interesting suggestion. Haman clearly had other plans, right? Because he's the typical anti-Semite, all right? Who played on?
Well, so is Haman. Actually, Achashverosh is more typical. That I'm not really anti.
Some of my best friends.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, that's Achashverosh. Some of my best friends. Not all my best friends, but some of my best friends. Yeah, I mean, people say that. We all work with people like that. It's very difficult. But I don't anymore. I used to. I worked with a guy who informs me. When Menachem Begin became Prime Minister in 1977, I was working in an office in London. So the guy in charge says, I don't know how they did it. So I said, what? He says, the Israelis have chosen a terrorist as a Prime Minister. So I looked at this guy. Terrorist? He hasn't been a terrorist for about 40 years.
Right.
So what is the story? This guy was a British soldier in Nathania, right? In Nathania, as he put it to me. 1947. Of course, his friends were getting shot by the Stern gang, right? And as far as he was concerned, Begin was a terrorist. So I just did not go there. I didn't want to go into any, because it's a difficult one to fight. It's difficult. You know, as much as we complain about Arafat, they've got this tiner on people like Begin, which is it's not going to be much longer because the new generation is not like that anymore. They're not from that era, so you can't really.
The generation is worse. They believe everything the Arabs say. So.
Well, no, I'm talking about the new generation of Israeli leaders. They're just not going to be from the Stone Gang and from the Irgun. And
Sharon
is still the connection.
The old school.
The old school. Yeah. All right. We'll just see a bit more of
no,
this
Begin
particular
was
item.
Worse.
This is. Begin was the ultimate.
The
oh. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, what he did with the British was unbelievable. So it was kind of interesting. You know, some of my
Excuse
best friends.
Me.
I remember that.
Some of my best friends, I personally think the British deserved it.
Oh, though. Totally. Oh, I'm not
going
to deny it.
They stood by and watched a massacre taking place in Kevro.
They
stood there.
They wouldn't
on their horses
lift
and let it go
up. Lift a gun.
They didn't deserve it?
Yeah.
They deserved it.
Yeah. There were individual soldiers who were very pro-Jewish, but the overall thing was horrendous.
But Britain,
biased
the
beyond.
English have always been Arabists.
Arabists. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Famous.
Lawrence
yeah.
of Arabia.
Yeah.
They loved the Arabs.
Yeah. Well, it's all to do with oil, isn't it? It's all to do with oil. We'll just see a bit more of this one. Just listen to this. The Sefer Talmud Dikrola, Goran Ruchaim Kanievsky, Shlita. It's interesting. He quotes Rabbi Kanievsky, who's in Bnei Brak at the moment. He writes like this. Divrei Matkot Tzorich Tam. Katav Sha Mechira Lo Haita Ela Ala Nashim Ibnei Chafat Bnei Sama. This whole thing of the Mechira, the 10,000 shekels, which he sells the people to, is only the people from the age of 20 to the age of 60. Shehem Yotzei Tzava, who were going to the army. Shaleim Bar Cheshbon Shalaseret Alefim Kikar Keser. Now, of course, I'm not quite sure how he brings that in terms of the pasuk, how he works that out. I'd have to look at the sefer and see how that works. That's the suggestion. Avol Me'olam Lo Nosen Lo Rishus Laragas Anoshim Batam. But clearly, what Reb Kanievsky wants to suggest is that to kill the women and children, there was never permission for that. In other words, he's not quite happy to say there was never permission to kill anybody. But he's saying that the permission to kill was very limited. All right, it certainly was not man, women, and children, with the women and children bit. But Zeh Shasha'al, and that's why Achashverosh says, "Mi hu zeh shegazar afalem? Who made such a gazera on the women and children?" Another possibility. Whichever way you look at it, now you understand that there were two stages to the gazera. All right, there was initial gazera, which, and according to what he says now, the fi zeh yesh lama de fata tatzato. What's the breaking of the Eitzah of the Council of Haman? Koyala Eitzah Shenatan Achashverosh. This is the original Eitzah which he gave Achashverosh. Kemosha Katavti La'el. The Atzato, the Eitzah was to evangelize them, if you want to put it like that, to change their religion, which Achashverosh agreed to. And then Vekilkalta Machshavto, you spoiled his Machshava, his intention. Koyal Machshevet Haman. That was the full intention of Haman. Ma Shehosif Midilei. What he added of his own accord, Marshalot Siv Achashverosh, that which Achashverosh did not command. That's an interesting, that's a
thing. But
figure.
Actually, it does balance better in the way that maybe that Achashverosh wasn't quite as bad, because out of Achashverosh and Esther supposedly came Darius, Daryavish,
yes, yeah.
who allowed the rebuilding and returning and everything. So maybe...
It may play out. All right, we'll do section D. Interesting thoughts for the Megillah, things to look at, things to think about. Final section over here for today, and we'll just try and get through much as we can. The hanging of the 10 sons, the last bit of the Alanisim, was Solos of Esponavaleit. He was hanged with his sons on the tree. All right, so let's see again. Got a problem about this? Why did the sons deserve to die? Okay, they were sons of Haman. What did they do which was so bad? So there you have to go into Midrashim. And you'll find that they were involved, they were very much part of the process of stopping the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. All right? The sons of Haman were very instrumental in that particular attempt. You know, it started at a certain point, and it stopped.
I may be wrong, but I remember learning that initially Achashverosh was allowing the rebuilding of the temple, and Haman, under the name of Memuchan, right? Comes along and says, no, this is not a good idea,
and he quashes the plan.
I seem to also recall as part of that, I don't know,
and then maybe
the
his
Gemara
10 sons. He brings this here. We'll see in a second. Let's just have a look at this. He says, this is the first paragraph. We'll go through this very quickly. I'll just paraphrase the end. He says, Hinei b'inyan shatzlias b'nei homon ala eitz, avabishab suki lo mefurish ishtatfu ba'atzas homon la'arugas ayudim. Doesn't say that they joined into the council of destroying the Jews. They really were enemies of the Jews, gam lifnei ma'aseh Purim, even before the story of Purim. Kedisa Barashi, Esther Rashi brings this, right? It says over there that b'shem ha'seder olam, in the name of the Sefer Seder Olam, she'elu aseres b'nei Haman katvu sidna al Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. They wrote a very negative a letter of hatred against Yehuda and Jerusalem. Kamosha katub b'sefer Ezra, as it says in Sefer Ezra. U'b'malchus Achashverosh b'techilas malchusa, the beginning of the kingdom Achashverosh, katvu sidna al Yeshvei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. They wrote this particular letter, which was very anti. Umahi hasidna, what was their plan, their negativity? Levatel ha'olim min agola, to stop the people coming up from Babylon back to Israel. B'yamei Koresh, as it was in the days of Koresh, the king. She'etchilu livnot et abayit, they started building the temple. Ve'hilshinu aleihem akutim, and the kutim started spreading rumors. Ve'chedilum, and they stopped it. U'kishamet Koresh, and when Koresh died, Umolach Achashverosh, Achashverosh became the king, Vidnase Haman, and Haman became elevated to power, Da'ag, he was worried, Shelo Yasku Otam B'Shev Yerushalayim B'Binyan. They shouldn't start building the temple again. V'shalchu B'Shem Achashverosh L'Sarei Eva Anoha L'Vatlan. And they sent in the name of Achashverosh to stop the rebuilding. So the temple stopped, it started, and part of the stopping was the 10 sons of Haman. Harei she'osan aseret b'nei Haman, those 10 sons, hayu otan shebatlu binyan beit hamikdash. They were the ones who stopped the building of the temple, b'techilat malchut Achashverosh, in the beginning of the kingdom Achashverosh. V'yachtav achshav nakmu hayudim amnehem, the Jews took revenge, v'tolu gam otam al'ez, they deserve to be hanged. So that's an interesting ha'ara. All right. The question is halachically, and here comes a real bombakasha. Halachically, how can you leave them hanging on the tree for a very long time? All right. There is a halacha which says lo solin nivlos oleit. When a person is put to death, you don't leave the body hanging. You hang it up, you take it down again, and you bury it. That's the rule of capital punishment.
You look in Sefer Yoshua with Kibush Haaretz. Every time they can't ad ha'aref, they left the body hanging,
and then they threw it
in a cave.
And here, all of a sudden, they're left hanging for a long time. All right, they're left hanging for a long time. So you'll say to me, all right, apart from the thing with Sefer Yoshua, but maybe it's only Jews that you're not allowed to leave hanging overnight. Maybe Goyim is not the case. Rashi holds that halacha refers to Jews. All right, but Rashi has a problem with that story of Yoshua. Ramban, he brings over here the bottom. You see the bottom line. The bottom line of Ramban, Shom Cholek HaRashi, was Sover Shegam B'Matei Akum Yesh Isuze. The Ramban says it applies to the non-Jews as well.
Right.
In which case, how could it happen over here? All right? The interesting suggestion is, look at the wording of Alanisim. V'talu oto v'et banav ala eiz. Who's v'talu? Who did it? Right? Who killed Jesus, right? It's back to that question. It wasn't the Jews. Right? It was Mel Gibson. It was the Romans, right? V'talu. So who hanged them up? So it could very well be that
it
wasn't, in fact,
it was
Sarim Shel Achashverosh. It was on the orders of Achashverosh. At the suggestion of Esther and Mordechai.
Or Chavona.
Zachor Latov, who was also a big Rasha. But the reality was, apparently according to the Midrashim, he's Zachor Latov just for that one thing. But everything else, he was a bad guy.
No, from what I understood, and this makes a lot more sense. Not that he pointed it out, but because he pointed it out, right away he was hanged.
Right.
Because Haman, being the way he was, if Ahasuerus had first thrown him into prison, he would have figured out a way to get out of it.
Oh, the fact is that he did it immediately.
The fact that he did it immediately is
good.
Why we remember Haman
Latov. Yeah, because there's not much else to remember him
Latov.
Right,
Latov. Right. Because he was one of Haman's guys.
He was one of the guys.
Yeah, but he was smart. He saw which way the wind was blowing.
It's a strange thing. I don't know. Just listen to this. It's the last couple of lines of that second column. Four lines. But Ulai Yeshloma. So what are we going to say if it's not allowed to leave the body up there? Shlo also a Yehudim atliya. The Jews did not do it. Ela biksha Esther shamalchut teosiken. It was actually Esther's request of the king. All right. But often zeh leket esuklan. Therefore, to request it of them is not quite the same as you doing it yourself. Which it's kind of interesting. He quotes at the bottom here, and I'm just going to mention this as something to look at. If you've never looked at this before, there's something called Targum Sheni. Targum Sheni. You have this at the back of the Chumash. It's a Targum which is not a regular Targum. It's a bit like Targum Yonatan ben Uziel. If you look at Targum Yonatan on the Torah, it's got massive amounts of Midrashim in it, not to be found more or less anywhere else. They are very unique. And there's a big debate in the scholarly world when exactly Targum Yonatan was written. Yonatan ben Uzi is mentioned in the Gemara, 2nd century of the Common Era. The trouble is, in one of the places in Targum Yonatan, it mentions Islam, which only came about around the 7th century of the Common Era. So you can't have it that it was Yonatan ben Uzziel writing the whole thing. All right, maybe he wrote some of it and somebody else added bits. Whatever. That's Targum Yonatan. There is a Targum on the Megillah called Targum Sheni. Targum Sheni is a very similar style. The trouble is, it's all Aramaic. So once you get past the first couple of lines, you find yourself not really understanding what's going on. There are commentaries on it. And if you really, Aramaic, back to that. And if you want to learn it, there are commentaries which, Matargumim. They're Matargim, Matargum, right? They translate it into Hebrew. It's a fabulous thing. If you've got really, I've never seen it before, look at the Targum Sheni, it's worth it. All right? I've tried, my hope this evening was, apart from trying to understand a bit of the wording of Alan Nisim, was to get you to look at the Megillah on Saturday night and say, oh, something different. I'm looking out for certain themes. All right? I now know maybe what Haman intended as opposed to Achashverosh's intention. I now understand maybe a bit more about the 10 sons of Haman. All right? That they were involved in the plan to stop the building of the Mikdash. That's why they were hanged. I now understand maybe a bit more about Esther's position in terms of being the Malka, as I mentioned before. All these types of themes are so wonderful. And when you actually think about them, when you look at the Megillah takes on a different shape. All right? It's not the same story because you're looking for nuances which you maybe have never thought
but
about
then
before.
And if it's at Amalek, then it's a mitzvah.
You've got a
mitzvah
to kill them anyway, so it's not really such a great kasha. But it's interesting that he brings over here from the Targum Sheni the same idea, that Esther actually made a request that the body should remain hanging. And he says at the bottom here, Velo Osu Kein Ela Baharosha, this was kind of a special case, and it was done on a special basis.
Isn't it a deterrent to the rest?
And one assumes that would be it. It should deter them.
But even my third graders today pointed out, if only 500 were killed in Shushan and only 75,000 were killed in the 127 countries, most people slept in that day.
Most people slept in. Yeah, they kept away from
them.
Yeah. So the whole story, the numbers, the mechanics,
very small,
the mechanics of the story is very hard.
But
very
the question was asked, why does it make a point twice? By Shushan, by the number 500, and
right.
also by the 75,000.
And by the others.
To point out they did not touch any spoils.
Right.
The Jews touched nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
There obviously is a reason.
They were obviously told that this, maybe halachically, there was a reason that they couldn't touch it. It was like, Eren Idachad. It was that sort of status. Maybe something like that. I don't know. It's very interesting. Very interesting. So even in the little area of Alan Nisim over here, we've, I hope, sort of whetted the appetite in terms of the story, some of the Heora, some of the stuff that we'll think about when we read the Megillah. Because the beauty of it is that it's got to be, it's always the same story. It never changes, but it's nuances. You see some nuances there which you may not have seen before. And that's the excitement of learning Tanakh, essentially. It never changes, but the nuances. Right?
You learn it very differently when you're a kid to when you're an adult.
Oh, yeah.
And you start going through the Gemara and you realize, wait a minute.
There are real problems.
Mordechai were man and wife.
I didn't even want to get into that whole subject because that's a real issue. And the fact that the story ends without really knowing what happens to Esther afterwards. And we know that she stays with Achashverosh.
She has no choice.
She lives
with him. She can't go back to Mordechai.
Yeah.
Once she gives herself freely.
And that whole concept of her, and she has a child with him, that becomes very, very difficult, Esther Malka is very nice when you're in kindergarten, but when you think about her further along the line, it's not so straightforward.
But people don't want to know
Not
that.
So straightforward. And,
Once
and
did a shear, and the women were incensed.
People get very upset.
Incensed, and I said, it's not my creation, it's in the Gemara.
People get very upset.
They get very upset.
I know. It breaks your child image of the whole thing. I wish everybody Feirich and Purim. Really, enjoy. Hopefully a bit more insight into what we're doing. But don't get too drunk. It's not good.
I learned
Lakewood, it's right next to
the But I learned